Hello and welcome to this EG podcast on the future of Bristol. I'm Damien Wilde. This session was recorded for our Future of UK Cities Week. Having chaired many question times in the city, I know a visit to Bristol is always rewarded with a lively debate. This one is no different. There's a bit of politics, but mostly you are left with a strong sense that Bristol is a city with a clear vision which stakeholders understand and endorse. Still, don't expect the panel to see eye to eye on everything. This is Bristol after all. Listen in and see what you think. Bristol sits at the heart of the fastest growing region outside of London, with a reputation for prioritising sustainable and inclusive growth. But like so many cities, it's facing its most challenging time. So how does it plan for recovery and for, hopefully, that next phase of growth? We have a star-studded panel to discuss this. Councillor Nicola Beach is Cabinet Lead for Spatial Planning and City Design at Bristol City Council. Pete Gladwell is Head of Public Sector Partnerships for Legal and General Investment Management. Una Goldsworthy is CEO of Brunel Care. Paddy Hales is Director for UK Investments at Savills. And Claire Reddington is CEO of Watershed. And don't forget, those of you tuning in, you can join the debate on Twitter using the hashtag EGFutureCities. Welcome, everyone. It's great to have you with us. And if there's one measure of the success of a city, is its level of its engagement with its constituency. And if that is the case, then Bristol has nothing to worry about. We've had a rush of questions come in for today's session, which will hopefully make my job easier, if not yours. And I suggest we go straight to some of those audience questions. And I'll start with Adam Pearce from the Government Property Agency, who asks, what does Bristol need to do to ensure it's not left behind other UK cities, which now seem to be the focus of policy and investment? Nicola, I'll start with you. And in terms of policy, being the focus of government attention can be a good or a bad thing. But if that translates into investment attention, it can also cut both ways. Do you think Bristol risks being left behind?
I think this is a challenge that we're really aware of, particularly when you get into sort of the north-south divide conversation and this idea that kind of that is a kind of binary thing. You're either in the south and you're all right, Jack, or you're in the north and you need support. And I think it just, from our perspective, it's just really important that it's not a zero-sum game on that. You know, we need a change of that relationship between Whitehall, Westminster, and a move to being in a more genuine partnership. I think what we look at, kind of the dynamic we're in at the moment with policy, we think about the white paper, we think about the devolution bill, the environment bill that are coming through. You know, I don't think anyone thinks that COVID, you know, hasn't sort of rightly been at sort of the forefront of everyone's mind this year. But between that and Brexit, there's all these other things that actually we really want to move the country forward that are challenged this year and are therefore delayed. And so I think that it's just not quite as sort of straightforward as sort of being left behind. I think the entire nation really needs to get to grips with devolution and what that sort of partnership relationship between cities and combined authorities and the government looks like. I think the last one I would also talk about is kind of how what we do. So between our sort of relationships within WECA and the Western Gateway, but also our core city relationships, where we are sort of united with those cities across the country, many of which are in the north of England, sort of actually work together to sort of represent our citizens and represent Bristolians when we're talking at a national stage.
And it strikes me that that's one of the more positive consequences of the last 6 months, that cities themselves, core cities particularly, have come together and stand a little bit more aligned and perhaps are stronger for it. Do you think that's the case, Nicola?
Yeah, absolutely. I sort of look at some of the sort of recent kind of activity that's happened. So I'm from Salford originally, so still follow northern politics very, very closely and sort of look at some of the things that have happened in those northern cities recently and just how much more in touch, I guess I might be bound to say this, they are with the kind of people that they represent. And I think that gets to the heart of devolution. So when we all come together as core cities, we realise we have an enormous amount in common. You know, our identities, our culture, our sort of, you know, our kind of the vibe and feel of our cities might have their own nuances, but we're faced with very, very similar challenges. And I think that really unites us as people that are representative of urban populations.
Okay, thank you. Paddy, can I bring you in there? So if the government's policy attention is shifting elsewhere, does that translate into investor attention shifting elsewhere as well?
I think it's really disappointing. And I do think that Bristol does need further investment in infrastructure and having central government support for that. But I'm really positive for Bristol's future. And I'll explain why. And it's just how the world has changed and it's playing into our strengths. You know, cities and towns grew originally because they had a natural or environmental resource or advantage on someone else, be it a river crossing or a port or coal reserves. Whereas now, the greatest resource to all businesses is people. And there's a fascinating study done in America recently by MIT, and it looked at why did certain cities grow better than others. And the primary reason was it was in places where people wanted to live. And what people have thought in the past is that people go for business. No, businesses go to people. And if you can attract the right people, businesses will come there. And that's why we're going to thrive. I mean, to make the point, I mean, I think the UK's most recent unicorn is Gymshark. And they're opening their US HQ. Where do they decide to live? What was the primary driver? Where was the nicest place in the US to live? And I think this is where Bristol really does stand out. You know, we continually voted the nicest place to live, continually voted the nicest place to work. However, we're going to have problems with the lack of investment in some of the infrastructure to ensure that we maintain ourselves as a nice environment for people to live and be able to afford to live and work.
And has that been made harder by the experience of recent months?
Are you referring to COVID, or are you referring to the government's decision to potentially invest more in the northern cities than they are into Bristol?
Well, arguably those two are linked, perhaps. But all that's happened over recent months, whether it's a levelling up agenda or whether it's changes driven by COVID.
I think COVID will play to our strengths. I think what COVID's done, and we'll touch on that later, I'm sure someone will bring up about working from home. But I think COVID has given people the knowledge that they can work from different locations. So the choice of where you live is going to change. And there is going to be a change in our relationship to London. So I think London will be arguably the biggest loser with office use. And I think people will decide to move from different. People will still use London. People will still go there, but they won't go every day. They'll go twice a week. And I think the nice cities, nice places to live will benefit. So I think that plays into our hands. I think Bristol will be the electoral hub and spoke. I think we'll win from that. I do worry about the promotion of certain infrastructure projects we're not getting. We've got a great motorway system. We really benefit from that, but that's not for the future. I mean, environmentally, it's terrible, but the amount of commuters we get coming from Wales and Chepstow and Caldicot and from the Cotswolds, I mean, it's all very nice. But you look at long-term benefits of the environment, we're going to struggle. We've got to find other routes, and that's where I think we're going to find some stresses and strains.
Okay, thank you. And Claire, can I bring you in? Bristol, relative to the rest of the country, a city with such a strong cultural reputation, and that is a sector that has suffered more than many others. Has Bristol suffered more than other cities, or is there just that cultural strength give it a cushion?
Yeah, I don't know if it's suffered more than other cities, but it is certainly suffering. We are certainly having a difficult time. I think the relationship of culture, hospitality, nighttime economy, all of those things are really linked, and they're difficult businesses to be in at the moment. And of course, they're also the businesses that make Bristol a nice place to live. They're the things that give people a sense of connection, of animation, of belonging or inclusion. As part of the City's Clusters project, which we're involved in with the universities, we've been doing a bit of research around who is doing well in the creative and cultural sector. And I guess one of the things that does play to Bristol's strength is, in general, small digital businesses with diverse staff seem to be doing better at pivoting online. And that really does play to the way that Bristol's sort of creative industries is made up. Lots of SMEs collaborating together to make kind of internationally relevant and brilliant projects.
Okay, that's good to hear. And Una, to bring you in terms of the work that you do, charity housing-led charity for older people. What's your experience of the last 6 months been? Has it got very much harder to deliver on the ground?
I think, to be honest, what we've been doing for the last 7 months, feels like longer, is really focusing on the care.
I said six, apologies.
Yeah, it's the care that we give to our residents, and we haven't really been able to focus on our development aspirations. Having said that, we did open a brand new care home on the 1st of April. It wasn't fantastic timing, I have to tell you. But, you know, we did it, and actually we also just opened a new extra care home as well in Bristol. So you can carry on developing even during this period. I think the thing that puts Bristol perhaps, I'm a bit more positive about Bristol and development in the future, is that we've got a really strong culture. It's matched, I think, to our arts and culture, a culture about smaller developers, housing associations and innovation, which actually can often be counter-cyclical. So we're not as reliant on the market. And I think as a sector, we can actually carry on developing. We can carry on looking at some of those more innovative, smaller sites, which if you put them all together, actually adds up to something quite considerable. So I think during the hard months that we've got to come, and maybe even years, I don't think there's anything that's going to stop us as a sector, as a housing association, affordable housing, stopping building. In fact, actually, I think we'll probably accelerate.
Okay, thank you. And Pete, to come to you last, going back to that original question, what does Bristol need to do to ensure it's not left behind other UK cities, which seem to be the focus of policy and investment? As a long-term investor, when a government starts talking about levelling up or starts responding to a crisis like COVID, does that alter your thinking?
I mean, I think it's easy to be pretty superficial and crass about this if you're sat in London or in Whitehall and you just think levelling up, you know, and you kind of point to the north of a map and think, oh, right, that's probably talking about that bit up there. And I think, you know, if we're not careful, the very question displays a kind of casual approach to this, which ignores the dynamics of people's lives, which I think is actually one of the things that I love most about Bristol, is that there seems to be a genuine care from the council and, you know, people like Brunel Care and others of real individual people's lives. And when you dig in beyond the kind of superficial, oh, look, it's the north versus the south, as Nicola says, I think you realise that a place like Bristol, there are still plenty of areas that, you know, for want of a better word, need levelling up. They need investment, whether that's infrastructure, whether that's, you know, sites that could be developing for affordable housing that aren't coming forward yet, the sites that the city are developing. I think it's just a bit crass to say, oh, well, that's a city that's all doing fantastically, and that's an area that's really struggling. You know, if you look at even somewhere like Temple Quarter, right, in the middle of Bristol, and we're obviously a little bit involved in that, but there are many people involved in that plan, including Network Rail, Homes England and the council. You know, that's a huge driver of economic growth for the whole region. And I think MHCRG have got that message. I think Number 10's got that message. And it will actually help play a dynamic in changing many, many people's lives across the whole region. I think that's easily lost if you just separate into a north-south divide. You actually recognise there's parts of Bristol that have a real role to play in benefiting people's lives, and it's incumbent on all of us to try and make that a reality.
And I'm not sure whether you're suggesting that that's not fully appreciated in government, which takes a more distant approach to those considerations.
I think I've avoided answering that question.
Okay. I'll let our viewers and listeners draw their own conclusions on that. Of course, there's plenty of questions to get through here, so I'll give you a little bit of latitude on that one. You've used your one card. Moving on to the environment and that notion of building back better, you know, which we've talked about. There's a lot of cliche around here. And Paddy, I'll start with you. And the question is from Andrew Hardick of Carter Jonas. How do you reconcile the requirements of the environment, including air quality, with the desire to have a thriving economy in Bristol? Is that circle being squared, do you think?
I think the biggest benefit and change that's happened to Bristol is its investment in its city core. And urban living is better for the environment. Your CO2 footprint is better if people are living in an urban rather than a rural economy. If we can get people living and working in Bristol city core, people are going to be traveling less and they're going to be using less of the environment. It's, if you look back to where Bristol's come from and where it is today, it is, its city core is what excites me the most. I think what's been touched on by everyone on, by Claire, by Una, and also by Peter talking about Temple Quarter and the fact we're growing our city around a transport hub, which is so right. And the fact you're talking about floor plates and the small businesses that was brought up earlier. And that's why we have such a good TMT sector, because these are the spaces that people want to occupy. I think we're in a very good place to help the environment, because we're trying to invest in the city core and bringing people back into it. Gone are the days where only development, I mean, we lost people in the city from 80s and the 90s. You know, the reference to the specials ghost town applied to Bristol in the 70s. But that's totally changed. And I think we're now seeing people re-look at the hub of Bristol and try to work. It's the small distances that matter. It's those small transport movements. People who are walking and cycling to work. I've noticed the council may recently have been increasing the cycle lanes during COVID without anyone looking too hard. Brilliant. I mean, what a very clever thing to be doing. You know, there's no traffic around. No one's going to be up in arms. It's always the loud minority that prevent these things happening. So I think what Bristol's doing, if you see, we've got problems with air pollution. And hopefully someone decides that everyone can ride scooters everywhere, which I think would be brilliant. But what Bristol has done and what it is doing, you've got to say it's doing everything it can, bring people back to the city centre, try and develop around central transport hubs. You've got to give it a big tick.
Okay, I saw Nicola smiling there at the notion that no one was up in arms. I suspect that wasn't her experience. Perhaps Nicola, I'll bring you in. Actually, that Bristol does have that reputation for focusing on a sustainable economy, but can of course go further. Is that a priority for the council as you look at 2021 and beyond?
Yeah, I mean it absolutely is, in terms of how do we leverage this unexpected position, I guess, the nation has found, the globe has found itself in, to actually understand when people say build back better, when they talk about these things, like what does that mean for us as Bristol, and how does it support us kind of, I'm going to say, be a bit experimental with what we can do. So I was smiling about the idea that we had our transport team out at sort of midnight with cones in the road, sort of just very covertly trying to sort of block off bits of tarmac, which isn't that far from the truth really, I guess. And so I guess what COVID showed me, and I was really proud of the council actually and the council officers, is the ability to pivot really quickly when under enormous pressure and actually just have a go and do those things, as in the extended pavement cycle paths and making those things now permanent, like the closure of Bristol Bridge. Councils are not renowned for speed, and our council, I guess, is no different, to be honest with you, at times. But what COVID taught us is that actually there was this enthusiasm around, actually, this is a chance to reshape parts of our city core in particular, where we have, had this, real challenges around air quality, congestion, people's reliance on the private vehicle. And so for me, I'd say in answer to the question, the things that describe it, they're not mutually exclusive. You know, that there is no reason why we can't improve the environment, access to our city, improve our street scene, reduce car dependency and grow the economy. Those, it's not a binary choice. And I think what I'm hoping for is, as we make some of these changes in the city centre permanent, like Bristol Bridge, which is one point closure but makes a massive difference to how people move around that city in a vehicle, we can start to sort of actually strike that balance between building the city that we want to see, bringing people with us on that, but also making space for the particularly, I think we'll talk later on about how more residential the city centre has become. And I think that actually, from my perspective in terms of city design, is absolutely at the heart of these transport improvements, is actually making space for the people that live and work there and want to visit us. And so that has ramifications in culture, nighttime economy, art, rethinking streets as kind of spaces to just wander around and enjoy places like Old City safely. And so don't get me wrong, balancing growth and a more sustainable environment is not easy and will continue to have challenges. I don't think today we have the answers. I don't think tomorrow we'll have all the answers, but I think it's having the honesty and kind of integrity to talk about it and also be realistic about where those challenges are, but take opportunities when we see them. And the cycle paths, I guess, is a good example of that.
And talking to a number of cities this week and previously, the challenge is going to be taking some of these temporary measures and making them permanent. And there's been a high degree of goodwill around measures that are temporary, whether it's cycle paths or restaurants having more outdoor space. Do you think it'll be easy to transition to permanency there?
I think you could take Bristol Bridge and those cycle paths as a kind of a microcosm of how we all feel about COVID full stop. I guess we all sort of thought at the middle of this year, this was all temporary, and now we're realising maybe it's not so temporary. So the idea of a cycle path in the kind of context of a global pandemic sort of feels to me like it's just a small example of the emotional rollercoaster we're all going through at the moment. So, you know, I think we'll crack on, to be perfectly honest with you. I think it's a great thing. Of course, we need to make sure that all voices are considered and understood, and there are exceptions, and we're working on how to gain access to venues and how to support them to be more environmentally conscious themselves around shared deliveries and all these things. But there are many ways to skin that cat. I don't think going back on where we've got to so far is the right answer.
Okay, thank you. And Una, do you think that that's an expectation amongst the people that you work with, that there is going to be have to be more of an emphasis on the environment?
Definitely, we all have. I mean, because we tend to focus on our new developments being, you know, the best environmental qualities. But actually, if you look at it, it's all our existing homes. And we've got a lot of properties that are really bad in terms of energy performance. So we know we've got to do something about that. And actually, it's in our plan to do it in the next few years. Can I come back on something, though? Because I think one of the strengths about how we deal with these massive changes is how we work as a city in terms of partnerships. And what we have in Bristol is we have the One City Plan, but aligned to that is a whole group of city leaders that Nicola and Marvin pulled together amongst colleagues. So it's not just seen as being a city council, local authority led change agenda, that by bringing together the bus company, the universities, the business sector, health sector, everybody, as we've been doing for the last few months during COVID, just in our response, there is building now a real legacy about how we work together in the future. So I feel that all those debates, and actually I've been part of some of those debates where we've looked at some of the issues the bus companies have had with the cycle lanes. And because there's a conversation that doesn't have to go through lots and lots of different levels, it means that there's a trust between all those different agencies. So it makes change much more easy, and it also makes it much more dynamic.
Okay, that's positive to hear. Claire, just thinking about some of those that you interact with and work with, and you talked about the pivoting that some of them had undertaken. There's another question that's come in from Nicholas Hubbard of Greig Investments, which overlaps. How will cities adapt to the significant reduction in commuters even coming to them as more and more people finally realise that working remotely is now here to stay? There's a presumption there. But is that, I suppose, do you think that presumption holds, and is Bristol ready to adapt?
Well, I think for Watershed, certainly, we're in the middle of that adaption, because most of our workforce who can work at home are working from home. But of course, we're also a public venue, a cafe bar and a co-working space. And some people simply can't work at home. They need connectivity. They don't have the right setup. Their mental health is suffering during working from home. So I think a mixed approach is going to be really important. And that's true for culture too. We've done lots of experiments around how we create hybrid experiences. So things that work in real life and things that also work with virtual audiences. And I think that's going to be key. Working from home is great in that it gives people, it's more inclusive. It allows for more access for lots of people, but it doesn't fit everyone. And I think, again, Bristol's mix of sort of smaller co-working spaces with larger offices, that flexibility hopefully will make us really well set up for that.
And digital connectivity is an important part of that. And Bristol has been one of the UK's major 5G test beds. And that's going to be crucial to making this change a success, isn't it, Claire?
It is, absolutely. And we've done lots of work, not only on the kind of delivery of 5G, but also ensuring that companies and creatives and artists and communities understand the potential of 5G and also can criticize it, can ask questions about the ethics. But digital isn't that straightforward. There's still a huge gap in who has access to handsets, who has access to authoring the kinds of experiences that we're talking about. So it's important that in a place like Bristol, we try to come at it from both sides, I guess, the innovation angle and the social equality angle.
Okay, thank you. And Pete, this point around marrying the sustainability requirements of a city with economic success, that goes through, as we've discussed, balancing home working and office working, transport, infrastructure. When you're looking at a city like Bristol, do you see a city that's getting it more right than perhaps others?
I think it's one of the reasons we spend so much time in Bristol is, I mean, Una's already mentioned the One City plan. You know, it's fantastic to have a city that has set out its stall and said, this is what we want to be. And if we want to be a city for our citizens. But, you know, if you read that plan, you'll see that kind of connectivity and the environment are deeply embedded. They're some of the key themes of that key plan. And so you then look, you know, you say it's legal in general. Well, we're stewarding, you know, I think the number of customers we've got in Bristol is 120,000 people. So that's 4.5 times the Ashton Gate Stadium in terms of the number of people who have in Bristol who have put their money with Legal & General. So, you know, we kind of say, well, look, if we're stewarding that many people's money within from Bristol, we need to be investing in to support those themes. If that's what the city has said it wants, and we're stewarding that much of the city's money, we need to be investing to help that to happen. And I'd actually agree with what Nicola said as well. I think around this isn't a kind of either or. There's lots of investments, whether that's wind power, solar, residential retrofitting, where it doesn't have to be some kind of fascist, hair-shirted, you know, we're going to kill the entire economy and put thousands of people into redundancy to save the environment. These are things that actually create jobs, they help level up, they create new skilled jobs, and they actually make returns that we can use to pay people's pensions with as we invest into them. But the key point is that thing that Una was referring to, which is working in partnership to say, well, where are the opportunities for us to invest society's money into residential retrofitting, for example, such that we can create that economic growth and that environmental benefit and generate returns to pay pensions with at the same time. That's the kind of key challenge. And I think Bristol genuinely is one of the cities that's at the forefront of doing that because it's got some great leadership.
So it can be, and it should be, a virtuous circle, perhaps. But at the same time, Pete, there's structural change in real estate going on. Town centres are changing. That balance between resi, retail, leisure and offices is happening. What's going to happen in Bristol?
It's a million-dollar question, but I actually think we've touched on some of the themes already, which is, you know, more housing in the centre. It creates that livable city. It reduces emissions from commuting, and it creates that buzz and that footfall that you know, COVID has hollowed out to some extent. I think a lot of repurposing of you know, redundant retail will create jobs, and you know, I just stress the investment is there. It's not as if you know, suddenly we as a country have absolutely no money. People's savings and pensions are still being well stewarded and looking for places where they can invest to make an impact. So I'm genuinely quite excited. I think the city is at a point where it knows what it wants to be, and it has leaders, and I don't just mean elected leaders, I mean actually civic leaders as well, who have clubbed together and decided they want to make that happen. And it's quite exciting to go to a place where you know there's a vision, and that's a people-centred vision, and there are real opportunities to actually support that vision and try and help make it a reality.
Okay, thank you. Paddy, how do you see the city centre changing in the years ahead? A more livable city, less retail, fewer offices?
I think everyone knows it. It's what's been interesting, actually, look back in time, is that everyone's looking at the death of the city centre. And ironically, I think we're looking at the renaissance of the city centre. And what is dying is comparable retailing based around a department store and a built shopping centre. But you know, I'm getting an old man now. they came about in the 1970s. I mean, they're pretty new. I mean, our city centres didn't used to be based around these one-size-fits-all shopping centre, and that's going to go. But what we're lucky about is that Bristol, not every city centre or town centre that we work for, but Bristol has the desire that people want to live and work in our core, and it couldn't happen at a better time. What's really important, though, is we've got to get the mix right. And it's difficult. I think residential is really, really important. And trying to develop at the moment residentially in our core, there are a lot of barriers. It's hard on a planning basis because people are more stringent about what's built for someone to live in rather than someone to work in. And there are arguably less returns to deliver residentially, but that's what we all want. So I do think there is some barriers in the way of what I think everyone on this panel is seeing Bristol City Core the same way. Everyone's talking the same language, which is very Bristol. I mean, it is a place where people just want to get on with each other. And it does have a slightly bohemian feel to it. It's fantastic. But there are barriers. I think the City Council has been great in what they are trying to achieve. They're going to be very important because a lot of the big problem areas, which are based around Broadmead, obviously built in the 50s very cheaply, having been flattened during the war, they are also the freeholder of most of that space. So their buy-in, which everything I've seen today is clearly there, is really important to help developers create what I think everyone on this panel is seeking to see in the centre of Bristol.
Okay, and just before I bring in Nicola to ask whether she's going to lift some of those barriers, Una and Claire, do you think it's inevitable that there will be more people living in the city centre in the years ahead? Una.
One of the challenges is that a lot of the land has gone for student development, and we want students and we need students, so it's not that we don't need them. But last year we developed a model which was mixing students up with other young people. So we developed a housing scheme where students can co-live with other non-students, and it's been hugely successful. And I think maybe that's a trick, that yes, we want to attract students and they inevitably live in the centre, but also they're not there for a large part of the year. So looking at some of those student type developments, can we mix them up? Can we bring other young people into them? Can we have other types of housing there? Would be a fantastic innovation. And the answer is, are we going to see more city centre development? Well, you know, Bristol's quite a walkable city. We're not a massive city, so actually you can live quite close to the centre. And some of those adjacent areas are going to thrive now as well, I think, because they've got those independent shops and streets and cafes. And I think once we can all go out again, and we will be able to go out again, I think it's some of those areas around the city centre that are probably going to thrive initially.
Okay, thank you. And Claire, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to go straight to Nicola. But Nicola, can you do more to remove some of those barriers to what the panel want to see delivered?
Notwithstanding some of the recent government behaviour in terms of planning, I'd just like to kind of push back on a little bit of it, I guess, because I think there's always a temptation to describe things that are hard as a barrier, but it's also a real representation of how much we care about quality. And so I'd love to know what you mean by barrier, Paddy, just because it would help bring that to life. Because I think it's, you know, I guess as cabinet member for planning, I'm constantly walking a tightrope where I'm nobody's best friend, because you're always kind of trying to square off kind of how you get the best result for Bristol when you look at all the things that are in that melting pot, I guess, on a particular site or a particular part of the city. And so I agree with much of what has been said. I think, you know, frankly, I'm reassured that Bristol City Council owns 50% of the city centre, because that makes us in a stronger position as landowner than the planning system would ever award us. And so that gives us, with the help work of our partners, kind of gives us that opportunity to build the city that we're all talked about today. And we obviously will have challenges around fleet of footness. So that's not an expression, but you know what I mean, speed. And that's a challenge for all local authorities. I think in terms of some of the barriers, I think the future of retail is something that I think we were getting to a point which we understood in Bristol pre-COVID, and I think COVID has changed that. So some of the things that Una was talking about those areas on the periphery of the city, and connectivity and the kind of renaissance of those high streets. There's facts, for instance, the city centre feels like it's moving eastwards, full stop. So as Temple Meads gets regenerated, that is having a weird impact in terms of where the core of the city is, which is great because, you know, what we've always wanted to do is be able to connect kind of the area around Temple Meads right into the heart of the city and have that as a kind of experience, I guess, of you connecting, sort of feeling like you're always in a core city at the point when you get off that train and all the way until you're at the Hippodrome or whatever, or watershed, I should say. I think I'll never apologise for the fact that we'll always strive for good growth and good quality. And sometimes that means you have very difficult conversations. But if you watch some of the recent sort of housing festival pieces that Marvin and I have been doing, you know, we're both very open-minded about the fact that we welcome anyone into our city and let's start to work together. And if you understand us and you get where we're headed, and I feel like we've put our stall out, so to speak, as Pete talked about earlier, then let's do business and we can grow the city together. But we're not afraid.
Okay. Nicola, I'm going to have to interrupt you there and we'll have the what is a barrier discussion next time. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for your questions. And thank you especially to our panellists and to our partners, Savills and Bristol City Council. Look out for online coverage with videos and podcasts throughout the week. And print coverage is on the 13th of November. Also, I hope you enjoyed this session and all our sessions throughout the week.
Thanks for tuning in to this property podcast from EG. You can subscribe to our podcasts for more conversations like this and more from our Future of UK Cities event. You can also watch the videos of these panels by heading to egi.co.uk/the future of UK cities. And of course, you can subscribe to Radius Data Exchange for all of our real estate news, analysis, and data. Bye for now.